welcome everyone to the session today. It's wonderful to have you all here. I want to start the session today by simply again thanking Paul and Susan for inviting me to be here this week. This is my last day here teaching, and so I'm very indebted to them. I want to thank Fred also for his sessions. I've just thoroughly enjoyed his Bible studies all week, and we've talked and seen a lot of synergy coming. And for those of you who've either come to one or all of these sessions, thank you for being here. It's been a real treat for me. If this is your first time here, I'm Roy Himmerling from Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota. And I teach in the religion department there. And one of the things that we do in some of our classes is we have time which we call mindful moments. It's a mindfulness moments. We're trying to start the class in a contemplative way, try to get students to move from the world outside into the world, into the classroom. And so what I'll do is I'll leave silence, and you may use the silence in whatever way you please. Here, if you'd like to have a moment of prayer, a moment of centering, if you want to just watch your thoughts go by. I sometimes tell students to imagine that your thoughts are like clouds, and if you want to just watch them, or if you want to blow them away, whatever you want to do, but be a few moments of centering. And at the end of that, I'll read a few quotes, and then we'll start into our discussion for today, which is about joy. So let's take a few moments. You show me the path of life, O God. In your presence, there is the fullness of joy. You have turned my mourning into dancing. You've taken off my sackcloth and clothed me in joy, so that my soul may praise you and not be silent. O Lord my God, I will give you thanks forever. Come and be love's willing slave, for love's slavery will save you. Forsake the slavery of this world and take up love's sweet service. The free, the world enslaves, but to slaves, love grants freedom. I crave release from this world like a bird crawling from an egg. Free me from the shell that clings to my back. As from the grave, grant me new life. O love, O quail in the free fields of spring, wildly singing songs of joy. The first two readings were from Psalm 16 and Psalm 30. The last reading, once again, was from the prophet Rumi, or the mystical prophet Rumi from the Muslim tradition in Turkey. Well, in order for me to get to the topic today of joy, I have to tell you a little bit about myself and how I came to kind of explore this notion of joy. When I went to Pacific Lutheran University, I was a triple major in classical languages, Greek and Latin. So I started reading the classics, and especially the Greek and Latin authors. And then I started, I was also a religion major, and I also spent a lot of time in the philosophy department, so I studied philosophy. There was something about the synergy of these three things, reading the great classical authors of Greece and Rome, looking at the philosophy over the ages, and also reading religious writers, biblical texts and things, that one day led me to kind of a realization about this notion of joy, because it was an idea that seemed to be cropping up everywhere that I was looking at in books. And so how am I going to get to this idea of something that has taken me kind of a lifetime to discover? And I wish I had a lot more time, because there are many authors that I could use to help us move through this. And unfortunately, the clearest authors, or the ones that made me have the earliest realization of this, were basically all male authors. But I should tell you that I read a lot in the Women Mystics, and we can find it there as well. And I'll maybe drop a few hints along the way. But today I would like to look at, first of all, Aristotle. We'll move to C.S. Lewis. Depending on time, we might touch on Tillich. And then we're going to end with Augustine from the 5th century. I might throw in a little of Julian of Norwich or Hildegard of Bingen and some other authors along the way. But I want to kind of give you a larger trajectory of where we're headed with this notion of joy. So let me go back to Aristotle to start with. And usually, I've tried this out on a few different audiences, and usually when I start to say Aristotle, I can just see eyes. You know, just, I know whether you're going up to pray, dear God, no. But I remember I had Sarah Rohde was in a class of mine in an introduction to the humanities class, and we were reading the Nicomachean Ethics by Aristotle. And the students had the same reaction, oh, dear God, no. But usually it was later on, I remember Sarah coming to me many years later saying, wow, that book really changed me. And it's a powerful book. But let me tell you a little bit about Aristotle. Aristotle, as you know, is one of the three great philosophers in the Greek world. There was Socrates, his student Plato, and Aristotle was the student of, Aristotle studied under Plato and then developed his own school system. He's a rather remarkable individual because he became the private tutor of Alexander the Great, and as far as we know, two other future kings in the area. So he was incredibly influential. He had a son by the name of Nicomachus, or Nicomachos, and he wrote this book, The Nicomachean Ethics, for his son to try to tell him what it is about life. If you have to write one book for your children, you want to write a book that says, how do you live the good life? What is it that makes life good? And so for Aristotle, he is very, very logical. He's very, very methodical. And so he starts out with this. He says, okay, what do I know about life? Says, I know that everything has a purpose, first of all. For example, the purpose of plants is to grow and be a plant. The purpose of animals is to follow their senses and find a way to survive in the world and just be the animal that they are. So I'm delighted in the chipmunks just being chipmunks out here, you know, rushing. My wife and I were sitting down one day, and they come up and they're kind of on your backpack because they could smell the food in there, you know, and then you look at them and then they're gone, you know. So they delight in being chipmunks, but they're following their senses, right? So then Aristotle shifts the idea of everything in the universe has a purpose, and he'll say, so the virtue of all of us is that the proper function that we have is our virtue, to live into the function that we have. So, for example, the virtue of a good eye is to see. The problem of a good eye is if it cannot see, because that's what eyes are supposed to do. Now, everybody in the room is going to think I made up this next example, but I did not. It's Plato's exact example. He says people also have purposes. So, for example, the flute player, which is my wife, the flute player's purpose is to make good music and to entertain and to help people to enjoy life. Now we're starting to see this joy theme coming out. The purpose of a doctor is to heal the sick. Now he shifts slightly the terminology. He says every craft or skill that we all have, that we pursue in our lives, is our purpose. It's the place in which we go to be virtuous. So, for example, Aristotle says, the insane and the fool are the only people in societies that live with no purpose. So the fool says, I have no purpose, and the insane just doesn't know anything any better. And so Aristotle says, you can't blame them, but you can blame the fool. Likewise, he said, therefore, when we come around in life, we have to make certain decisions about our purpose. Are we going to follow our purpose? For example, the eye could say, I'm going to keep my eyes shut, and I'm not very good to the body. If I decide to keep my eyes shut all the time, I'm going to actually hurt the body if I'm not fulfilling my purpose. And the same thing is true in the rest of society. Now, here's the next move that sometimes we as people don't always notice, but I think it's quite a powerful one that Aristotle has. And this is going to connect through the other authors that we're going to talk about in a minute. So Aristotle says, okay, so now when I start thinking about how I make decisions, I think Aristotle says everyone makes a decision based on what they think is good for them. So for example, if I have two apples between on the table here, and one is rotten and one is good, I will choose the Honeycrisp over the rotten apple, right? I've often puzzled over this in my own life, is like when, let's say, there's a loaf of bread in the refrigerator, and I know all my kids are going to come down and want toast, which piece do I take? I always take the good one. Even though I know they're coming, I still are kind of, you know, so I might think, okay, well, maybe I'll take the heel this day and leave it for the other ones, and you know. But basically, we make decisions based on what is good for us. Aristotle thinks it's inconceivable that we would make a decision based on something that's bad. If we have a choice between good and bad, we'll always choose what we think is good for us. And then he says, well, I'll come back to that idea. Hang on to it, okay? So I'll come back. So right now, then Aristotle says, okay, well, what types of goods are there? There's really two. We have momentary goods. We make a decision for the moment. I choose the good apple. I eat it. And a few hours later, I'm going to have to make another decision because that's going to not last much longer, right? It's a momentary good. So that's how a momentary good works. But we also have lasting goods. And these are decisions that we make which help us to have a good life. Now, momentary goods can contribute to the lasting goods, but they can never be the lasting good. An apple can never be a lasting good, right? It's just not possible. So momentary and lasting goods. Now he makes a shift. Then he asks another question. He says, so if that's true, is there something called the craft of life? What does it mean to be human? So he goes back for a minute. If plants are to grow and animals are to follow their senses and to be healthy and alive, then what is it about humans that is virtuous? And he says, is that we should live according to reason, that we should live in a way that allows us to live our own virtuous act, so we do those things that we function well to do and provide for our society. Then he asks, and what is the highest good of life? For Aristotle, while being good at our crafts is admirable, while being good at your purpose in life is admirable, there is still more to life. For example, I'm going to just make a hypothetical situation. I could be the best golfer in the world and still be a person that's not so good. I wasn't trying to imply that. Yeah, there's a real life example there. But you know, you could be the best golfer in the world and maybe not be good to your wife, or you could be cruel. You could be best doctor, or you could be the best musician. And there's still something beyond our own purpose. So Aristotle says, well, what is that? What is that thing that's beyond us? And Aristotle says, it is to have a happy and good life. Not a momentarily happy good life, but a lasting happy good life. And the problem, says Aristotle, is that he looks at life and he's talking to his son at this point. He's saying, the problem I've had in my life is that while I'm pursuing lasting happiness, I often think I can find it in momentary happiness. And I confuse the two. For example, let me use my wife as an example. Let's say we have an argument, my wife and I, okay? We have an argument, and of course, I'm right. And she thinks she's right. And so we have this argument. And so I have a few choices at this moment in my life as we're getting ready for bed and upstairs and she wants to do something, I want to do something. Now I have a few options. I can pursue momentary happiness, which would be me being stubborn, walking down the stairs, slamming the door as I go outside, going up, calling some of my buddies and going to a bar. And I want to get rid of the pain that's between my wife and the frustration we're having. So I start drinking a few beers, right? And that kind of works. It kind of takes off the edge of the pain. I'm with my buddies. We're joking and we're saying how wives are always unreasonable and it's, you know, all these sorts of things and, you know, what's wrong with them? And then by that time, if a couple beers works, I'm down through the six pack and suddenly, you know, I'm using momentary things. Beer can, you know, it makes me numb in the moment. But then when I come back home and in the morning, I have to deal with the questions of lasting happiness. Right? Aristotle would say in my example, what I should do is I realize that I can have lasting happiness with my wife because lasting happiness for Aristotle is about the ordinary. It's not about the extraordinary, it's about the ordinary. So the ordinary thing that we have is that we're in a relationship, we have three children, we live together, we work together, and I have the decision, I could go to my wife and say, okay, help me listen to you, and we try to resolve the issue, and we go to bed, maybe resolve, maybe not happy, but at least at least go to the same bed instead of having me out at the bar, you know, complaining with my buddies, right? And trying to find that momentary happiness. If I come back the next morning, I've got a big headache. Things are even worse, right? I can make things worse by pursuing momentary happiness, thinking that that is really lasting happiness.
Did you stay home while you were gone?
What's that? She may have gone to her mother's and father's place. I come home, it's an empty bed, and I'm suffering. If you're here last night, you'll know what I'm talking about. So she may not be there, right? You know, but she might be seeking momentary happiness too, right? She could say, well, screw you, I'm going to mom and dad's, you know. And you'll see my divorce lawyer later. So now, lasting happiness always comes in relationships for Aristotle. It always comes in the ordinary things of life, the simple joys of life. But be careful, says Aristotle, do not mix the two up. Because you can control momentary happiness, but lasting happiness is something that has to be worked out. It's something that you can have, but it takes a lot of time to figure it out. Now, so the question really still remains, how does happiness work? How does that work? Are we clear on where I'm at with Aristotle? So
before? Yeah, but I'm wondering about a different situation. I'm a workaday artist. It makes me extremely happy to work on art. On the other hand, should I get on a plane and go work for Mother Teresa? Which probably wouldn't make
Well, I mean, again, Aristotle suggests that you know, your function, right, your craft, is something that you should do, right? And so that's something you need to live in to provide the virtue, that virtue that you have as an individual, your craft, you need to bring to society so that society can be a better place. Now, that other part is a question, right? We all come to that sort of crisis. And we sometimes think the gifts and talents we have should be subverted or be put set aside for the greater common good. Aristotle would say you probably will not be happy in the end if you set yourself up for the greater virtue. If even that can become a momentary happiness because you might be just doing it for your own self-glorification. For other people to say, you know, Aristotle would say live out of what your talent is, but be a good person while you're doing that. And it might be that you support Mother Teresa, or maybe you find a way to make those things work. But the question is, it's not always easy to tell the difference, right?
Does he make any distinction between happiness and joy?
Well, that's where I'm going next. So exactly right, because now he uses the notion of happiness. Now C.S. Lewis, who knows Aristotle, is the next person I'd like to go to. And C.S. Lewis in his book, Surprised by Joy, it's in the bookstore over here, because it was one of the ones I said you could order. His book, Surprised by Joy, was written in 1955, right as he's just also starting to write the Chronicles of Narnia. So he hasn't written the Chronicles of Narnia yet when he's written this book. He has written some of them, but not all of them. And so let me tell you a little bit about Lewis and his life. Because Lewis is going to equate the idea of happiness with joy. He's going to shift the argument a little bit. But he uses a metaphor that I think is helpful to all of us. So Lewis comes along, and he's an interesting guy. Lewis dies the exact same day that John F. Kennedy dies and Aldous Huxley. And so when Lewis died, nobody really knew it, because the assassination of Kennedy was in the newspapers, and it was 1963 in November. And Lewis had grown up, he was born the same time my grandfather was, so it's interesting, when I think of Lewis, we all could have known him. He was a young man, lived in Ireland, moved to England. World War I broke out at the age of 19. He gave up college and he went into the trench warfare in France. There on one day, a bomb blows up, kills the two people next to him, and he's hospitalized. He goes into a terrible depression. He's sent back to England. He eventually studies medieval literature and philosophy and religion. Sounds a little like me. I did pursue my career partially in light of him and Tolkien, what they were studying. And so he has this interesting life, and in 1955 he writes Surprised by Joy. Surprised by Joy is an interesting book. It's basically mostly about his childhood, because he says that's always the most interesting part of people's lives. Once they get older, they become boring. And so he writes a little bit about his adult life, and especially his conversion. But he makes this interesting observation at the end. He says he looks back at his life, and he asks the question, what is life all about? So he's basically asking the same question that Aristotle's asking. And he frames it slightly differently. He has this experience of his brother having a shoebox in which he kind of unfolded it out, and he pasted little plants and trees and put a little frog and things in there, and he made a toy garden. And he brought it to Lewis and gave it to him as a present when he was very young. And Lewis said when he opened it, he had this moment of wonder. You know, just seeing this beautiful gift that his brother Warney had made for him. And he said, it seemed like I was lost in that moment of that little toy garden. You know, it was a moment of wonder. He said, I had this, after I walked away from that, I always longed to kind of go back to that toy garden. I had a longing for longing, which is the sub-theme for today. I had a longing for longing. I longed for that moment of joy, which I was lost in it for that moment, and then all of a sudden, I was outside of it. So my life was basically one longing for that longing. You know what that's like? It's like Christmas, when you're a little kid. For me, the great joy of Christmas was always leading up to the presents, never opening them or seeing what was inside, because I was always disappointed. My imagination was so much better. There has to be a pony in that box. You know? It's just a little toy truck. So, you know, it's like this longing. Leading up to it is the longing that you really want, that joy. But what you don't really, when you get it, it seems like it disappears. Well, at the end of the book, Lewis uses this illustration to try to explain the happiness phenomenon, which he will call joy. And Lewis says there's a difference between happiness and joy. But he'll use this. He says, I was once in a dark wood wandering. Anybody know where that comes from? It's the opening line of Dante's Inferno. So he goes back to Dante's Inferno and uses the opening line. I was once in a dark wood wandering, sad and lonely, lost, and wondering where I should go, and having no idea where my home lies. And then I came upon a sign, a signpost, pointing the way home. What did I do at that moment? In my momentary joy, notice the word, momentary joy. In my momentary joy, I ran up and I hugged the signpost. And I stayed there, not going on to my home. Now, wouldn't that be foolish, said Lewis? The point of the signpost is that it points home. The signpost certainly makes me happy. I've been in the dark wood wandering. I didn't know where I was going. I have joy. That's the way home. Great. Oh, thank you. And it just seems like I'm an idiot, right? Lewis says, I should follow the sign. I can't stay there. Lewis says, that's what we settle for when we settle for momentary joy, just like Aristotle's momentary happiness, right? We want to go on. So Lewis distinguishes between two things. He calls little j joy momentary happiness, and capital J joy lasting happiness. And when you read his autobiography, you have to be very careful on which joy he's talking about. Little J joy is hugging the signpost. Big J joy is him going on the way home to find that great happiness. And then he says a very interesting thing. He says, all my life, I look back and I realize that as I look through my life, I'm always pursuing joy, but it was this joy, little J joy. And when I realized that I was trying to find happiness in the momentary joys, I gave up looking for it there. And I started looking for home. I started longing for the longing that is within all of us to try to get back to home. Now notice how similar the idea is between Aristotle's idea of ordinary life and home and Lewis's idea. Lewis does know Aristotle well. He could read Greek at the age of about 12 fluently. And so he was reading the classic authors already at that age. And Lewis finally says that what I want to do is get back to that ordinariness of life and find true joy in there where I get lost in the moment. We've been talking about thin places and thin and thick time. Thin places, as I've said before, are those places in our lives where something, we come into encounter with the divine and we are lost in the moment. We are lost in the longing for the divine and for others. But it often comes in the ordinariness of life, not something that I can control. Now, one of the things I need to say is Aristotle argues, as does Lewis, that every joy that we have in life is a piece of the great joy. In fact, all of these always point us to this. Because they're momentary, we know that there's something greater out there, that we shouldn't pursue the momentary joy, but we shouldn't settle for that, but we should seek the great joy. For Aristotle, it was the love of the gods, right? He believes in the Greek gods, and he says that's what we should be about, the loving of the gods. Lewis says, ultimately, the great joy is loving God. How do we find the way to love God? What is that way that we do that? Well, that's the question, right? That's the hard pursuit. I'm going to just detour briefly into Tillich, I think, because it helps a little bit. Paul Tillich, a German theologian who lived through World War II, wrote a book called Dynamics of Faith. And in that book, it's a short book, in there he says, people have what he says are ultimate concerns. Everybody has an ultimate concern. He tried to break down the idea of pursuing God as happiness into the question of, well, how do we do that? And Lewis Tillich says, we do it by pursuing the ultimate concern. But if for a moment I make my ultimate concern my work, my craft, then something happens and it's a problem. It can be a problem. So for example, if I become a workaholic and I decide, you know, boy, I have this great job. I'm teaching religion. I'm forming and shaping young minds, and I'm really doing great things in this world. And I go and I spend all my time at work, and my wife is at home, and I ignore her and my kids. Suddenly, I've lost, right? But I've made my work my ultimate concern. I think this is something we get lost with very easily in life, that we somehow think that work is more important than the lasting happiness that we truly have. And all of us probably have been lost in that way so that our family has suffered to a degree. I know I have done that, and I regret it. But Tillich says you can make your work your ultimate concern, but then it's becoming a false ultimate. Because if you do that, the true lasting happiness that you could have in life suffers. So you need a true ultimate, says Tillich. But what are those true ultimates that we have? Well, for Tillich, he says it's found in the ground of your being. By the way, if those of you have been listening to me, Tillich gets this idea from Tauler, right? Tauler says, the idea is that God is the ground of our being. If you look within yourself, God is always at the ground. Because the longings that we have everywhere in life always point beyond themselves. They're like signs. But we are such fools when we cling to the sign and don't go home. But where is home? And it's not in the false ultimates, it's in the true ultimates. And now I need to get to Augustine in the 5th century to finally explain, I think, how we get to the true ultimate. Now, Augustine is an interesting guy. He dies in the year 430. If you remember your history, 410, Rome falls to the barbarians. So this is a time of tremendous upheaval. And Augustine is this bishop, and he's trying to hold North Africa together and do the best that he can with the people that are there. And he grew up with a loving mother who was very Christian and pursued him. And he thought in his confessions, he talks about her as being real nagging, and he tries to run away from her and he can't get away from her, and she's crying all the time. He really doesn't like her very much. And then his father, who has no Christianity in him at all, just wants him to be a great scholar in that. And Augustine does become a great scholar. He becomes a speechwriter for the emperor. He goes to Rome. He's got it all. He, as a youth, in his confessions, he describes being completely wild. He takes a girlfriend. They start living together. He lives with her for about 10 years. They have a boy that they name Adeodatus, which means means from, Deo, God, Datus, gift, the gift of God. And they have this boy, and the boy dies at the age of 16, tragically. He's incredibly intelligent, but he dies unexpectedly. And then while he's in Rome, he could become a senator. The only thing he really needs is money, so how's he going to get that? He puts his concubine aside. We never learn her name. Augustine never tells us her name. One of the great tragedies in literature. But he never tells us her name. He puts her aside and gets engaged to a girl that's 10 years old and who has tons of money. But he can't really marry her till she's 12. Or, you know, till she becomes a woman. And so he's kind of set her aside, and then he starts horsing around with other women. And he's got the world by the tail. Everything is going his way. And one day he's walking down the road and he sees a drunk by the side of the road. And he observes this guy, and this guy's really happy. And Augustine suddenly notices, says, you know, I'm not really happy. I put aside a woman I loved. My son has died. And this guy, I know that he's not going to be happy in the morning, but he's happy right now, and he's happier than I am. How pitiful is my life? And he starts to wonder, how do I get to happiness? Well, it's interesting. It takes him a long time. He has to struggle with this. And he starts writing his confessions. At the same time, he starts writing another book called On Christian Doctrine. And in On Christian Doctrine, it takes him the rest of his life to write this very short book. He can't figure out the secret to life until right at the end of his life. And this is the secret that he figures out. And he tells it in a story. And notice that when theologians get to a point where they find something really, really important, like Lewis with the hugging of the sign, they always tell stories. Because stories are able to use your imagination in a way so you can participate in the story and feel what it is that we probably can't understand intellectually. And so Augustine tells this story in On Christian Doctrine. He says, and I'm going to modernize it because I think it's fun. But I'll modernize the story. He says, I want you to imagine, he says, that I live in Spokane. And that I go on a business trip to Seattle. And I've had a successful business trip, and now I'm driving back, and I'm in Chelan. Okay? I'm on my way back. And I stop at a Holiday Inn. Augustine just says, I stop at an inn. Ours is a Holiday Inn. So I stop at the Holiday Inn, and I'm tired. And I call my wife, and I say, Peggy, I'm going to be back tomorrow. Everything will be great, and our blind dog is barking in the background, and our betta fish is jumping in and out of the little fishbowl we've got, and the kids are screaming back, hey, Dad's coming home, and Peggy says, I love you, can't wait to see you, and I say, I know, it'll be great. So I'm exhausted, I need to sleep tonight, stay here, and then I'll be there tomorrow. And so then the next morning I go downstairs, and I go, wow. This is really great. They have Lucky Charms, you know? My favorite cereal, you know? I love Lucky Charms. I never get that at home, you know? That's got too much sugar and all that other stuff I shouldn't have. But I love that. So I have a great big bowl of Lucky Charms, and they have one of those waffle machines, you know, with those little things. I pour it in. I make myself a bunch of waffles. I never get those at home either. I always eat well at home. I try to anyway. And I think, this is really great. I go upstairs, and I'm getting ready to leave, and I notice they put another chocolate on my pillow. I thought, wow, this is great. And then I look, wow, free cable? And they got a jacuzzi downstairs? I think, holy smokes, I have come to heaven and died, you know? So I call my wife up and say, hey, I'm going to spend an extra day here. You would not believe this Holiday Inn. It is so great. And my wife goes, well, what? I said, they got Lucky Charms. She goes, well, what about the kids? And all of us, oh, you know. I love you all, but I mean, you know, I'll be there as soon as I really enjoy this place. And then I stay there the rest of my life. So Augustine says, what's wrong with this picture? He wants to explain it with two Latin words. And the two Latin words are udi and frui. We get our word utility, and it simply means something to use, udi. And frui, you can see we get our word fruit from it. It means something that you enjoy. And so Augustine says, what is the problem with the story of the inn? He says, everything in life is something that we should use. Now, he's using the word use in a very different way than we are, right? So you have to kind of, that's why I use the word udi. I should use the word udi. So everything in life is something that we should use. How does that work? Well, for example, I should use that inn to get sleep so that I can get home. But the problem is, if I start enjoying the inn, then I've done something wrong, right? I've lost perspective. If I start enjoying the inn because of the Lucky Charms and all those other things, then I've lost what the inn is supposed to be for. Everything in life should be used so that I can get home, says Augustine. The opening line of Augustine's Confessions are some of the most powerful in literature. My soul is restless, O Lord, until it rests in you. What the ultimate goal of happiness and joy is rest, says Augustine. And the only place you can find rest is in home, your home. Now, where is that home? How does that work? Well, Augustine says there is really only one thing that we ought to enjoy in life that does not point beyond itself to something else, and that is God. How do we use the things of our lives so that we might make our entire life a thin place by which we pursue God and are in a relationship with the divine. Now he makes one example. There's one other thing you can enjoy in life. One other thing. In fact, you cannot use this. Or you can, but you've got things mixed up if you do. He says the only other thing that you can use is people. Or enjoy. The only other thing in life you can enjoy is other people. Especially your family. And those closest to you. But also your enemy, too. If you use your enemy, you've lost your way. You should enjoy them. You enjoy other people because in them is God. Because in them is rest. And in them is true joy. So, I use everything in life so that I might enjoy God. But if I start using God, which I would say some preachers do, right? They use God as a weapon. They use God as a means to money. They use God as a means, I'm picking on preachers because I am one. They can use God, but all of us, when we see that, we know instinctively that that's wrong, right? The way we want to go, what we want to do is to find rest. So we must enjoy others. Augustine says, the devil always blocks our way home by putting roadblocks of beautiful things in our way, of things that give us momentary rest, false joy. It is as if a wife who got her a wedding ring from her husband loved the ring more than the man. What will we use and what we will enjoy in life is important. One of the key lines in Augustine's confession is a prayer that he makes. I translated this prayer, and Renee Claussen, who's at Concordia College, has made a musical piece around it, and it was composed for the King Singers. And we're hoping that they'll be put on a CD in the near future, but I would like to read the text of this poem. It's toward the end of the Confessions, book 10. It's in a book about memory. I want to set it up a little bit. Augustine goes through his whole life, just like C.S. Lewis. And when he writes the book at the end, he says, all of a sudden I realized that I was pursuing happiness in all the wrong places. I was pursuing rest in all the wrong places. For example, and let me read the poem at this point. Late have I loved you, O beauty so ancient and so new, late have I loved you. You have always rested in me, even though I went out and nested in trees, from which I, though loathsome with misguided love, have soared, flying away from you, my great rest, to seek beauty on outlying shores. You were with me, but I was not with you. Captivated by alluring creations, I have winged after worldly wonders, which without you would not even exist to be, and yet I think they are you. Late have I loved you, O beauty so ancient and so new. Late have I loved you. You called out to me, thundering through my wind-whipped ears, and have shone upon me, bedazzling my obsidian eyes. Your sweet fragrance rose within me, and I began breathlessly to pant for you, for your essence. I tasted you, and straightway I hungered and thirsted for you as my food. You touched me, and at last I finally caught on fire in my heart, seeking that flickering flame of rest. You, my soul is restless, O beauty so ancient and so new, until it rests in you. For Augustine, you know that you're truly enjoying God when you no longer regret the past or look forward to the future, but you live in the moment in such a way in which you lose yourself in the present to the ordinary, to that which you must enjoy, and that is God and other people, and especially those closest to you, but also your enemies, or you could say even creation. It's interesting, in J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, which you may know, the very last line of the book, the very last line of all the book, is Augustinian to the core. Tolkien was a Catholic and he loved Augustine. He said, the whole purpose of my story is to teach people that home is the place to be. And the last line is Sam, the friend of Frodo. They've gone on this great journey. And I don't want to wreck the book if you haven't read it, but they go on this great journey. And Sam comes home. And the last line is he walks in and Rosie is making a dinner. And his child, Eleanor, crawls into his lap. And he says, I'm back. I'm home. And Tolkien said, that's the whole point of the story, that we must find our way home and not hug signs in the forest. So how do we find that joy? Ray Bradbury, the great science fiction author, just died a few days ago. You may have heard about his death. I was reading some of the interviews about his death. I love his writing, by the way. And in one of the interviews, the author asked him, do you pray? His answer was, oh yes. Every moment I have joy is my greatest prayer to the divine. In the end, happiness is the key to a well-lived life. Joy is the way, and rest is what we all seek. And we'll never find it unless we dare to be human and seek lasting happiness and stop using, enjoying things that we should use and using things that we enjoy, should enjoy. I hope that you'll find that lasting happiness not just in a signpost or in an inn, but in a true, beautiful home, in a life that's worth living and doing the things that are worth living so that you can be truly at rest. For you and I both know that there's nothing greater in this world than the joy of being able to rest with those you love, because in that place, there is the divine. Okay, let's open it up a little bit, see what thoughts that you have or any ideas. Does this make some sense to you, or do you have any questions? Or yeah.
Well, this is just a sideline, but I used to live in San Diego, and I'm from the Midwest, and when I was there, there was a point called Point Loma where people would watch the sunset, and it was funny because people would, in fact, congregate there and talk and till the sun, in fact, finally hits the sunset, and I would notice that all the car radios would stop, everyone would stop talking, and there would be this sense of loss, or sorry, a loss of self, of where you don't really even experience your own body, but yet you see the earth move within that, and that's not really in relationship to the greatest love with other people, but it's,
but it is. There's I've suggested that there are these other thin places like nature and that. If you've ever been to Santorini in the Greek islands, one of the traditions of the people on the island is always to go over to the west side of the island. Everybody sits there and eats every night, and as the sun goes down, like you say, it becomes completely still. And when the sun is gone, everybody claps. And I've often thought that is the sign of a civilized society, where you can rest every night and watch the beauty of that happen. And how often are we flitting around, you know? But notice that it's complete rest.
That's right.
You know, this society, I'm always struck by the people, not everybody in Santorini, but a lot of people in Santorini are so moved by being lost in the moment and by being with each other. And they are just resting. They're just eating and enjoying a meal together. My students have sometimes asked me, I'll ask them, what do you think is that great moment where you're in the presence of heaven, where you feel in heaven? And they'll turn the question around to me after they've talked for a while. And I say, what was it for you? And I'll always say, it's the moment my little children, my babies, my own kids fell asleep in my arms. I feel like I'm completely lost in them, and that's heaven. And I can completely rest. Nothing else in the world matters at that point, right? My job, whatever it is. I mean, I still have my job. I still love it. I like what I do. But that puts everything in perspective. Now, thanks for sharing that. I think we need more civilized societies.
Yeah, this fits with what you're saying and what you've been saying all week, but I would just, and I certainly resonate to the idea of finding joy and home with people. But the other, some other things on your list, nature, art, studies, you can also find joy and enjoy rather than use those as well. And even if it's all alone.
Absolutely. And even my argument last night, you notice that the reason I structured it with suffering last night and joy today is that even in suffering, you can have joy with those that you love. It's the only way that you can endure it, right? You're right, and it brings us back.
This may take a slightly different direction, but it uses some of the same words, but I was just terribly struck by the young man who did matins this morning. I don't know if anybody else heard it, but he talked of how appreciative of what he was of Holden and this and this and this, and he got, and I didn't hear him say, I found happiness here, although you could tell that, but what he did say was, what I learned at Holden is I learned to share happiness. Mm-hmm. We haven't really used the word share, and it seemed to me sort of profound.
This is exactly where Lewis is going with this. Lewis says, at the end of his Surprise by Joy, he says, I have given up looking for joy because it finds me.
Yeah.
And it finds me in those unguarded moments, and it comes, Paul asked this earlier, but it comes unexpectedly. And Lewis says, as soon as I realize that I'm happy or I'm joyful, I lose it. So I try to live in the moment and trust the joy that I'm in, and it lasts longer. And then all of a sudden the moment is, place is thin, the time is thick. And it's exactly what Augustine says about time. I try to live in the present. Augustine says the only place eternity exists is in the present. Because if you live mindfully in that moment, and that moment becomes a moment of thick time, like I shared about my father's death, being in my father's deathbed. And when I usually tell that story, I can't really get through to it because it floods upon me so powerfully. That I'm already back in that moment. See how eternal that moment is? And those eternal moments are the things that change us and make us try to be better in life. Or the world, sets the world right in some way. Not that I don't, and I love the last line of Lewis's book, Surprised by Joy. He says, and so I go on my way a journeying, but every now and then I still look at shiny rocks in the stream and hug a sign. So he even ends at the end saying, oh, I'm not very good at this. Mm-hmm. And I think we all aren't. I mean, that's the problem.
You can always marry your joy.
And there's still struggles there, you know. But marrying joy and being, when you find it, my daughter has this boyfriend who is an absolute wonderful guy. And the other day I was alone with him, and I was sitting there looking at him, and I said, I don't like giving advice to young kids, you know, especially my daughter, but I said, I think you two are nuts if you don't get married. I mean, you have so much joy. What are you waiting for? You know? I said, I promise I will never say another thing again. You know? I'm not trying to tell you. They're looking at each other like, what is, you know, this crazy old poop with a white beard is, you know. It's like, you're happy, you know? Why do we run from happiness? It seems like one of the great problems of our human existence, that when we have joy, we turn away from it and we go grab the sign. I do it all the time.
Well, just in response to that last comment, when you were going through this, I was thinking about the importance of Sabbath practice. Mm-hmm. If the goal is rest, that we really do have regular practice of stopping and being still. You know, why do we run from happiness? Because we run, period.
Yeah. We don't know how to stop running.
Run and run and run.
I think that's absolutely right. For me, worship becomes a place of thick moment. I would put it in with community, but it's really essential for me to find that rhythm. There's a certain rhythm. Now, you try to manufacture joy. You can even use worship in the wrong way, but when worship works right, when you're sitting, for me, I can remember a number of very powerful worship services that seemed to change me as a human being. where I felt at one with that community and complete rest, even though I'm completely different from all these people, and we somehow find joy together. I agree with you. Yeah.
This is a footnote, but I do think it's interesting that C.S. Lewis, a longtime bachelor, after he wrote Surprised by Joy, met Joy Davidman.
Yeah, Joy Davidman. Lewis is a really interesting guy at this point, because what happens is Lewis, he writes this book. He just has met Joy. He's writing to Joy at the time he's writing Surprised by Joy. And so some people have thought that there's a pun there on her name, Joy Davidman. Joy Davidman was a Jewish communist author in the United States, and she had two boys. In an alcoholic marriage, and she liked Lewis's writings, although she wasn't so sure about him, but she liked his writings, so she went to England to meet Lewis, and Lewis had no idea what to make of her. If you've ever seen Shadowlands, it's a fun portrayal of their lives together. He meets her, he marries her she eventually divorces her husband, and he marries her so she can stay in England, but he has no real relationship with her. He doesn't want to, he's not sure what to make of her. And she gets cancer, and in the process of her cancer, Lewis falls in love with her, even though he's married to her. But he really wasn't, you know, they had this intellectual relationship. And she has basically a miracle, as Lewis describes it, and she recovers for a short while. They travel around Europe, and then she dies of cancer. Lewis will only die 3 years later after she dies. In 1963, she died in 1960. But Lewis is so shocked that he really found this sort of happiness in life. There's a lot of controversy about Lewis's relationship with women early on, but this is one of the great gifts of his life, and it comes after this. I think it was one of those moments that came to him unexpected, especially in a woman that you would never expect that he would marry. I mean, it was a scandal at Oxford when Lewis got involved with her. Other thoughts or observations? Well, all I can say is it's been a joy for me, and I think capital J, in the sense that I've lost myself in conversations with a lot of you and really have enjoyed the week here. I hope that we'll keep in touch. I'm going to try to work this up into a book after I get my book on Luther finished, and I'm working on a book with Sarah. We'll get those out of the way. Work on this as a book as well. This is just kind of the start. When I was asked to speak by Paul and Susan, I thought, well, this would be a good opportunity to kind of float these ideas and see what you think. And so I appreciate you being a part of the process. And I do wish you happiness, joy, rest, and home. Blessings to you all, and thank you.